listening to the Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of the Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host and also the host of the Money Savage podcast, Mr. George Grombacher. George, how are you, bud?
I am doing great. Just like you were saying, man, it's a beautiful Friday here in Arizona as well. So
now, are you aware that it's Friday the 13th?
I was not until you emailed me this morning.
Yeah,
and I've been filled with a sense of impending doom ever since.
Yeah, I took a lot of grief from that, and I guess we're going to get into that with Oliver and Kevin when they join in a few moments. They're getting a lot of grief on that. And look, I have nothing to do with the date. I have nothing to do with any of that. I'm just here to keep moving forward, just like you are.
That's all we can do, man. I must say, I want to make sure that I close any loops that I may leave open from previous shows. And the good news is that the University of Minnesota Duluth Bulldogs are the national champions in men's ice hockey. So congratulations
to them.
That's great.
I did see that. I meant to reach out to you. So congratulations on that. I know you're excited as a Minnesotan. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
It is, in fact, Minnesotan. So.
Well, all those Minnesotans out there who are tuning in and listening, congratulations on the victory. Hard fought, I'm sure. And I'm glad you're happy.
Yes.
Happy George is an even better podcast. So George, you've got a great show lined up, a great guest. I think we're going to start things off with our friends, our dynamic duo on the Hill. I don't know what to call them. I think they're like the Batman and Robin of Capitol Hill, of legislation, of retirement. We're going to start off with our friends David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law.
Well, we should just go with Batman and Robin then.
Okay, well, I can't wait till we get them on. That'll probably be a question we'll have to query them on. So I think I'm ready to get started. How about yourself?
I am ready to go, man.
So let's do this thing.
Excellent.
Well, George, we're going to kick things off with our dynamic duo of Capitol Hill. I don't know what else to call them. Kevin Walsh and David Levine of Groom Law. Guys, how are you?
Great. Good afternoon.
Good.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I hope the day is as beautiful in Washington, D.C. and wherever you may be as it is in New York. We've got a close to 70-degree weather, although I'm inside and George is inside. So I hope it's real nice. David, last week you joined us and we had talked about the Fifth Circuit, and Kevin and yourself have been on for the past several weeks talking about that. But from your perspective, what's new? What's going on the Hill? Are there other things we should be thinking about, besides this fiduciary role, or have things move forward? So I wanted to get your guys' take on that.
Sure. It feels like every week is fiduciary rule week these days. And yes, there's things going on in Washington. But if anybody reads the news, it's benefits is not front and center this week. Let's be perfectly honest. There's a lot more going on. So the fiduciary rule, however, is back popping up. And many listeners probably after a while get tired of hearing this. But next week, we're actually going to get something. The Securities and Exchange Commission is actually holding a hearing. They're having sort of an open meeting. What they're going to do is actually talk about their consideration of guidance on the fiduciary rule. They're going to talk about sort of its three parts here. First, to have a disclosure for registered investment advisors and registered broker dealers about their relationship to retail investors. The exact detail on all of this, to be determined. But as we've heard from the chairman of the SEC, I think it's about transparency, about what is your role? What is your interaction? Could it be suitability? We'll find out more. Number two is it's also the so-called uniform fiduciary standard that came out of Dodd-Frank a little bit. The question is whether they should propose a rule about a standard of conduct for broker-dealers in recommending securities transactions or investment strategies involving securities. In English, it's basically, should there be a fiduciary rule for broker-dealers? And the expectation is yes, and soon after we'll probably get the proposal. The third point is a SEC interpretation of the standard of conduct for investment advisors. So you've got three things. In English, it's sort of, are brokers and advisors going to have to tell people sort of what their relationship is and what does that mean, number one. Number two, are brokers going to get sort of a fiduciary standard of conduct and what is that going to mean? And number three, is the standard of conduct for registered investment advisors going to be tweaked and clarified? That's the three parts. And we'll see where we are after the hearing next Wednesday. Kevin, you probably have some more thoughts on this.
Yeah, David, I think you did a great job at kind of highlighting what the three issues are. But to me, the most important question right now is whether it's going to be one rule or three rules. And kind of thinking about it, you've had kind of a traditional SEC approach, traditional Republican approach, which is more disclosure-based. You've had a traditional kind of DOL-style approach, which is more conflict mitigation style. And when you look at the three parts, part one, what's the relationship with your broker? What's the relationship with your RIA? That seems more traditional SEC-style approach. When you look at the next two, they both kind of standard of care for brokers and then reinterpretation of the standard of care for investment advisors. Those two seem like they're more DOL-style rules. So here, where you've got a number of commissioners that have to come to agreement to release rules, it'll be interesting because if they've all agreed on a single rule, then to me it signals that there's probably some support for everything. But if it's a package of rules, then there's some likelihood that there was some horse trading at the commission level to get a proposal out the door, and you could see more movement between an initial one and anything that gets finalized. David, do you have any follow-up thoughts on that?
Yeah, one other thought. Thank you, Kevin. I agree wholeheartedly. I think one other thought is, from a practical takeaway, what does this mean to everyone right now? The simple answer is you need to be paying attention, and you have to think, okay, where's the DOL going to be in this? The SEC only has authority over a large group, but not everybody involved in the plan space. They have authority over brokers and registered investment advisors, but that's it. So you don't have insurance. You don't have other groups like banks in here. So the something to keep in mind is, where's the DOL? We're coming up in early May, where the Department of Labor is going to decide whether or not to appeal the Fifth Circuit decision, which is, of course, where you started, Jeff. And let's say for a moment they don't appeal. If they don't appeal and the fiduciary rule gets vacated, the ERISA one, how is this going to tie together? I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing something from the Department of Labor. They do talk to each other. And there's probably some longer-term picture that will evolve. So for right now, it's looking, if you're a sponsor, looking at your plans and saying, well, what is my relationship to my service providers? What did they promise me? What are they changing? Is this work? And is this okay? Can that work? If you're a service provider saying, well, where do we want to be? And it's going to be, as I like to say, the 31 flavors of fiduciary for a while, because it's going to be like you're Baskin Robbins. Everybody is probably going to be out there for a while saying, I do this and I'm a fiduciary this way and that way. And we're going to have to see where we are. So for right now, it's everybody figuring out their business location on the service provider side. And for sponsors, understanding what people are agreeing to and not agreeing to and looking at your documents. That's my takeaway on it.
And David, you didn't mention it, but if you're an IRA investor, you're going to want to kind of know what standard of care is being used to make recommendations to you and to sell you products. Really keyed in on a super key issue here, which is the DOL rule and this SEC rule. The talk has always been about a move towards a uniform standard of care. And in the last 2 years, it's apparent that with the DOL, you have a standard of care that can be uniform across the retirement space, but not across kind of retail investment space. And now with the SEC rule, you highlighted that it might be uniform for securities transactions. It might be uniform for brokers and RIAs, but the SEC doesn't really have much regulatory power over the insurance market, for example. So those were great points to highlight.
Yeah, I think George, I got to tell you, I think this is it's interesting to see this kind of sea change and to see the SEC kind of step up. What are your thoughts?
I was curious. You mentioned that banks were one of the groups that were exempted or not going to fall under the purview of this. Who is, and maybe this is an obvious answer, but who's going to dictate what their standard of care is?
Well, the banks have different discussions. They have the OCC that they have to deal with. They also have things such as state regulators. Those are the first two that come to mind for me. Kevin, do you think I'm missing anybody?
Federal Reserve.
But thank you.
Yeah.
I knew I was missing one. Thank you.
I just figured I'd ask, with some of the large banks that have been in the news for negative reasons as of late, I was curious. So thank you.
Yep.
Hey, so guys, a lot of news out of Washington, D.C. I mean, obviously, this is top of mind. And as we were talking off microphone, is a scintillating conference this week in Washington, D.C. that David is and I are attending. So we'll probably find out some more things, because I think we've got some heavy hitters that are going to be speaking. So maybe we'll hear some little perks along the way. But what else is kind of going on? I know Speaker Ryan announced that he's going to retire. I know we don't get into politics on this show, but could that have influence on any legislation that we've seen or will see during this year? Because it is a midterm election.
Kevin, why don't you answer that one?
So I think there still is some hope that there's this bill that we've talked about a few weeks ago, the Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act, which is a bill that was introduced in the Senate a while back. It has bipartisan support. It would encourage kind of the development of open multiple employer plans. It would do a handful of good things in the kind of lifetime income area in plans. There was some hope that that would move forward about a month ago. I still, that's the big thing that people are watching. It's unclear if it's going to move forward this year. The House does not seem that interested in taking it up. That being said, as we get closer to the election, if it's a bipartisan opportunity for the parties to work together, and that seems to be something that would resonate with the public, it's an easy bill for them to pick up.
What was the name of that bill again?
The Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act.
Got it.
Or RESA is what they call it, right?
RESA, yes.
Well, and one other thing to add to that is there's also been talk for years of things like e-delivery, and that may come back up again as well. There's different schools of thought out there, but both on the sponsor and service provider side, there's views about all the paper that has to be generated and distributed. And there are some, and there's some who disagree with this, who have been working really hard for years on electronic disclosure. And I think that that's still on the radar, and that's probably something that will go forward. As we all know, more and more of our bills are going that way and other communications. So that's something else that I think will be on the radar.
Excellent stuff.
Yeah, let's hope we I understand that retirement, it tends to be a bipartisan issue. So hopefully we can get leaders in the Senate and the House to kind of work together and take, you know, pass some legislation this year. So, guys, before we finish, what are you all up to this weekend? A little light ERISA reading, out playing some ball, going to the Nationals game, Baltimore Orioles. What's going on this weekend?
I know I'm actually living still in the land of benefits. I'm going to the National Association of Plan Advisors 401k Summit in Nashville. So that will consume a good chunk of my weekend.
And I'm going to enjoy the weekend. Going to get dinner with my wife, but with the SEC rule coming out next week, there's going to be a lot of prep going on.
Well, guys, I hope you guys have fun. Take care in Nashville. David, I think that's going to be fun, and a lot of music. And Kevin, enjoy dinner. And we thank you guys so much for joining us on the show. And think of what we should call you. I like the dynamic duo, but you know, we need to give you guys a name. I think, you know, the dynamic duo of Capitol Hill or something. So think about that, and we'll brainstorm that while we're reading the SEC information.
Proposal.
Yeah, proposal. Yep.
Sounds great.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Welcome back, everybody. Jeff, we just finished up a great segment with Kevin Walsh and David Levine from Groom Law, covering all the goings-ons on Capitol Hill with the fiduciary rule and the SEC. And now we've got two of our favorite, if not our most favorite guests, Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade and Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg. How are you guys doing?
Appreciate the love.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love that.
And everybody's got their beverage of choice. We don't need to get into that necessarily, but I think, I can't remember who started last week, but you guys want to flip a coin? Tell us what's going on with the markets?
I went first last week, so I'll let Ollie take the lead here.
Appreciate that, Mr. Kelly. You know, there's a lot going on in this market that I think is pretty interesting, as always, really. That's kind of the status quo now when you get volatile markets. But what I've been thinking about today, since we'll talk about a little bit of the news of the day, because I think it really applies to the week as a whole, we've got strength in some important areas, same type of theme we've been looking at. But even when you have days in which that strength from financials and tech stocks are not there, you have something to kind of fill the gaps. This week's pretty important because right now, if things hold together and we don't get another Friday bloodbath, then the 5-day period is going to show up to be something pretty good. Best week in little bit over a month. And you look at that, and things started off Monday on a pretty important note, which was upgrades by analysts on companies that have been very emblematic of the excitement around equities and the excitement around growth companies. We start off the week with upgrades on Micron, with a company that was already rallying to an extraordinary amount in the first quarter of the year, Seagate Technologies, a memory device company that was also a favorite of investors in the first quarter of the year. Then right behind that, you also had upgrades on NVIDIA. Of course, we all know the story with the chip maker. So the fact that there are prices that are moving higher that then analysts are trying to catch up to. Today we had that also with Netflix. I think got a lot of people excited about semiconductors, got a lot of people excited about technology, kind of set the stage. Then today we get numbers from banks, and what we're finding out is even though the net interest margin story and the rate at which rates are increasing is maybe not to what folks expected for this year, banks are making up for it, and they're doing it through big jumps in trading. Now, we got Citi and we got JP Morgan this morning, and those aren't even the equity trading powerhouses. That is more in the Morgan Stanley category, which we're going to get next week. So, I mean, the idea here is that you've got support on a lot of different levels. Economic data is, while softening, you know, the sentiment numbers are still really high, and there's been actually a lot of great work done over at Bloomberg's equity markets team writing about not only sentiment, but just the degree to which active managers have been able to hold on in this market. There's a lot of excitement about trading this new environment, and I think investors are readily accepting this new regime, and it's hard to really see how you get a major downdraft when that type of readiness to buy still is there.
Yeah, nice. I would echo a lot of Oliver's points, you know, per usual. Pretty spot on with what's going on this week. You know, one thing I'll add a little bit of color to, and I think the bank story is one that's really interesting, and I would love to see if there's anything that Oliver's seeing or hear from him after this that I haven't, because I've dug into some of the numbers, but probably not as extensively as he has. But what is interesting to me is that you did get this, to his point, you did get this increase in trading revenues, both, you know, on the big ones on the equity side. We've seen a lot of equity volatility return to the market, as we've talked about on this show, you know, the last few weeks. Part of the confusion for me, at least right now, is some of these stocks are actually trading down on the day, right on the day in which they're reporting. Could be a little bit of guidance, could be some commentary around maybe volatility will remain or will become subdued a bit here in the second quarter. But, you know, I think the broader implication for, you know, the stock market in general is we're going to be watching over the next couple of weeks as the earnings season really kicks off. I think this is a pretty key earnings season, right? You've had a lot of volatility recently. The market's still, you know, below its all-time high back in January. And so we're trying to kind of crawl out of this correction, the corrective process that we're in right now with stocks. Q1's going to be huge. We're kicking that off this week with the banks. But what we're going to be watching for is the price reactions to not only guidance, but the earnings numbers that come out for these companies. I mean, traditionally, if you see, you know, a lot of good news come out of companies, but they're trading, you know, relatively flat or down on the day, that could be, you know, a little bit of negative sentiment going into, you know, the rest of 2018, because typically that may signal more so a near-term market top. So, again, agree with a lot of Oliver's points. Not sure if there's anything on the bank side that he's seeing, but that was something that caught my eye, that a lot of these, you know, Citi's and J.P. Morgan's and a lot of the S&P 500 bank index in general is down today.
Yeah, just a good point. I mean, that's really the big, big lingering matzo ball, if you will, in the market, to quote George Costanza, because there is there's a history and a routine that investors have gotten used to, which is when companies report earnings, the market goes up. You set the bar low, and you climb it easily. That's worked throughout pretty much the entire bull market, the better part of about last 2.5 years at least. There was that period from 2015 to 2016 when earnings were pretty weak. So notwithstanding, though, the past 2 years, this has been the case. Now, at the beginning of the 2018, there's this huge ratcheting up of expectations. So to Kevin's point, this is going to be one of the most important things to look at, is not so much necessarily if they can meet the expectations for their earnings in the trailing 3 months that we're going to see for the first quarter, but if they can line up corporate guidance with Wall Street's expectations. And if that starts to narrow, then you start to see some cracks in the story for whether or not these companies will be able to live up to expectations. I mean, look, everybody knows the market's an expectations game. Maybe that's what you see this morning to come full circle to some of the financials, but it's tough. You know, I don't know. There's not really a whole lot to that I would think would cause a 3% sell-off in JP Morgan, but alas, it's there. There is the risk that, you know, too much volatility becomes bad. So volatility, just the right amount of volatility is great, and it gets people trading, it gets, you know, revenues up in these banks, but if then everyone just leaves the market, that's not great. And if companies don't want to come in to IPO in a public market, that's not good for the investment banking side. So, there's obviously still a lot of ifs, but I think we'll get some answers pretty soon.
So when, you know, there are, I guess, three – I mean, there were many major events, but there were three main events that I think wanted to get your take on in terms of how it impacts the market. The first was obviously the testimony by Mark Zuckerberg earlier in the week. So that was, I guess, front and center where he was testifying in the Senate. The second was, you know, there was a little bit of a, I don't know, outburst is the right word, but the president definitely was not happy. Many of the allies were not happy about this Syria, I don't know, issue, what's going on in Syria with the chemical attack. And then later in the week, Paul Ryan had hinted earlier in the month that he might retire, and now he's definitely going to retire. How much do these events, I mean, I imagine there are factors to what people are thinking as it relates to, like, commodities and other, but do you see great movements when these things are occurring during the day? I mean, Oliver and Kevin, you're tracking this stuff almost in real time, so just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'll kind of bat lead off here for that. Just taking those in order, I mean, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, I thought he handled himself really well. I think, you know, it was good to see that he did that on his own kind of voluntary basis. I'm sure that's going to be start of more than a few of those types of testimonies from some of these large technology company CEOs and executives. But I thought overall he did really well. The market thought he did well because the stock's been up, was trading, you know, 2 or 3% higher in real time while you were watching him testify. I think there's also, you know, part of it was a formality, but there is a disconnect, I think, between, you know, lawmakers and the rapid increase or innovation increase for these technologies. And you could see it in some of the questions. I mean, there were a lot of really good questions that were asked, for sure, and there were questions that needed to be addressed, and there were kind of the big elephants in the room about data concerns and privacy concerns. But there were some that, you know, there were some lawmakers, for example, you could tell didn't really have a full-fledged understanding of what Facebook even did, the importance of connectivity and things of that nature. So overall, I think, you know, it was addressed that lawmakers really kind of need to take it upon themselves, I think, to learn about these things and understand full circle, you know, the benefits and the cost benefits of each. So that in the near term, obviously, was important for the market, important for Facebook, important for a lot of those other tech companies. The Syria escalation, that's, I almost kind of view that as a binary event in some sort, because, you know, it's very, we've talked about this before, it's very difficult to price in geopolitical risk until something major happens, right? And that's when you might see a market sell off. Or you might see, you know, an increase in volatility around those events, right? It's pretty difficult to understand or try and price in when that's going to happen. But when it does happen, it's kind of a one or none type situation where it all of a sudden gets priced in at a very rapid, rapid pace. And then with Paul Ryan, yes, definitely important for markets. But I think that's much more of a longer term trying to figure out exactly, you know, who would take his place. And that's a little bit more of a longer term implication for the market. So the long-winded answer is yes, all of these things do matter. I think the time horizon for which each is, you know, Facebook and Syria much more short-term versus Paul Ryan being a little bit more long-term.
Yeah, I don't really think too much about political leadership too much. It just becomes too much a mess, and it's not really my forte. So I won't comment too much on what Ryan means, but, you know, this Syria stuff is pretty clearly responsive, and I think markets are pretty clearly responsive rather to things like Middle East tension and tweets about potential conflict. And it's largely a sort of risk-off move. We had Chris Verone from Strategus on the show this morning, and he made a pretty interesting observation that if you look year-to-date, really the only quote-unquote safe haven, if you take safe haven universe as being, say, consumer staples, utilities, U.S. bonds, treasuries, as well as gold. The only one that's been positive here today is gold, and that's largely because on days where things like that Syria tweet happen, you get like more clear kind of push to safety slash whatever, you know, people kind of call risk off. Other than that, the risk-on-risk-off relationship trade is just, there's no really way to make sense on a day-to-day basis of what is risky, what's not. There's so many different concurrent headwinds and tailwinds for just about every asset class. It really is a unique period. I mean, that can pretty much be summed up as VIX 20, but that's sort of what I'd say about that. Yes, you do see pretty clear reactions in futures and markets when there are tweets about that type of thing. And then with Facebook, I mean, it's on the mend. It's up. You'd think that was a pretty well-telegraphed example of a sort of gap between public and sort of media coverage and perception of who Zuckerberg is and what exactly his company does and the actual market implications. I mean, what we were saying from the get-go is that a very hard battle to fight is won against a media coverage of your involvement in the U.S. election from 2016. I mean, there's so many hot-button issues involved with that was going to be a tough road for him to go on. But, I mean, at the end of the day, guy's a multi-billionaire CEO, shows up, did a decent job. I mean, I think that it's pretty well summed up by the fact that all the lampooning of his antics happened across Instagram, which is his product. So at the end of the day, I mean, nothing's really changed for this company, I don't think.
Excellent stuff. Oliver Rennick, Kevin Kelly, great job again.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good one.
Well, George, I got to say, you know, it's always fun with Oliver and Kevin, and they're so they always talk about some really great topics. Hopefully the audience was able to take some things away from that. So we've had really some great segments of what's going on the Hill and also what's going on in markets. But I think for this week we've got a very special guest who's going to talk to us about mentorship, something that's I think in some ways missing in a lot of ways in our culture and maybe also in corporate America and also plays a role in retirement. We've got Julie Cantor. She is the CEO of Two Mentor. Julie, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm delighted to be on with both of you and part of the Morning Boost.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, and we're so excited to have you. This is a little bit of a different segment for us, but we think it's absolutely vital. You know, a lot of our listeners are individuals, people preparing and saving for retirement. We also have a lot of people who are on the institutional side, so people that work for big organizations that help people plan and save for retirement. But I think what you're doing is so vital. To one, developing cultures and enhancing cultures. But I think from your perspective, there's a lot that can be done in terms of retirement and retirees.
No, absolutely. I think that, you know, our different with the five generations in the workplace right now, there is a huge opportunity for both traditional mentoring and for reverse mentoring, where the skills needed in the workplace, but also a lot of the skills needed for retirement or an encore career, skills needed with technology. There's, I think, a huge opportunity right now for more mutual mentoring. And why mentoring should be so important to us is that in one company, it was actually Sun Microsystems, Jeff, and they had a mentoring initiative. And after 5 years, Wharton and Gardner studied this initiative, and the people who mentored got promoted 6 times more than the people who didn't mentor. The mentees got promoted 5 times more, and retention rates were 20% higher. And from a financial perspective, when you lose a good employee, that's 100, the loss is 100 to 300% salary, according to Society of Human Resource Management and more. So we really want to have a more retained, engaged workforce, and that's where knowledge transfer, mentoring, reverse mentoring is just critical, and it makes people feel more engaged and also happier in the world of work.
Such a powerful thing. Obviously, mentorship in general is such a powerful thing, but certainly as a company's trying to do the things that you're talking about, increase retention, increase engagement, I know just from the work that I've done with mentorship is people support what they help to create, and if you also give someone a great reputation to live up to, the Sun Microsystem example evidences that these people were getting promoted. So obviously if you tap them on the shoulder and say you're an important part of our organization, we'd like you to help groom the future, what a great impact that has.
Yeah,
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, right now, one of the big challenges with retirement, I mean, one is that 40% of people don't feel they plan to retire after the age of 70 because they don't have a strong enough nest egg. And Department of Labor, in their research, the average American stays in their job 4.4 years. But with millennials who were born between 1980 and 2000, they're staying on average 2.2 years. So who are you going to pass the baton to? Who will take on the learning and be the our next leaders and keep industries alive? We have Generation X in between, but there's almost twice the number of millennials in the workforce than Gen X right now. They're just it's just a larger generation. So the high turnover is incredibly costly to America, and the lack of engagement and retention that Gallup has really studied, which the overall engagement rate is about 32%, and 17% of people are actively disengaged. This opportunity for us to help each other is a real driver of engagement and retention. And I think retirees have a critical role to play. And also, I think we'll find it incredibly fulfilling.
Yeah. Go ahead, George.
I think that the role of community plays such a huge role in changing behaviors and changing behaviors for the better. So if an organization, I don't care if it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit or whatever, if they can create and foster a community of support and sharing and certainly mentorship in this example, it's all the better. So how does an organization go about doing this?
Well, I think it's important to put a stake in the ground to whether we're going to build a mentoring culture. And I think we should look at it through one additional lens, which is that in a Deloitte study, 79% of millennials wish their managers were mentors. And so I think the first thing is to determine if we're going to have a mentoring initiative or drive a mentoring culture, and then really look at what do people most want. I know one company, a BNY Mellon company called Perishing, and their executives, all over 50, each have a millennial mentor. For the millennials come in and work with them, and when these top executives have big concerns and issues, they send it back, and the millennial group comes together and comes back with solutions. And the retention rate's been 96%. Of the millennials who were mentoring the higher level executives. So I think that figuring out whether we want to put a stake in the ground and start an initiative at each company, it was very popular about 20 years ago. And then I think as a country, we kind of got away from mentoring and apprenticeships. So that's something that I think figuring out if we're going to do it and then how to get started. And, you know, we recommend having an action like an action plan, an action guide, mentor training, mentee training, make it fun and dynamic, have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and have people get together, whether it's 1 hour a month for 9 months, put something in place, and then evaluate some of the impact and results to figure out how it can be better scaled.
Yeah, I think that last item, certainly measurement and being able to measure and figure out and adapting is critical. And I know, I think one of the things that I've always talked about, Julie, is kind of redefining retirement. And, you know, retirement, when I was kind of coming up in the workforce, and I'm now middle-aged, I guess, sometimes I feel older and younger, depending on the day. But, you know, when I was coming up, it was, you know, you're gonna sit on the porch and sit on a rocking chair and just relax or go play golf. But mentorship could be kind of that next vocation where you are actually passing along that vital information, whether it's in an organization, your community, as George suggested. And I got to think that there's some good retirement, or I wouldn't say investment knowledge, but good knowledge that can be gleaned from each successive generation. And when you don't have that cohesion, you actually lose your culture. And because you don't have that bridge. And I think that's something that we're definitely missing in this country.
Yeah. And a lot of people are afraid a little bit of mentoring. They're afraid I'm going to mentor this person, and they're going to take my job. And so really looking at the true win-win, like in the Sun Microsystem example, it was a win for the mentor, a win for the mentee.
And due to retention and more and culture building, it was an incredible win for the company, a triple win there. I was at a party, and my old boss came, and we were sitting around having dinner. I ran a charity for 20 years teaching entrepreneurship to inner city youth. We were actually headquartered in New York. And my old boss came, and I started talking to him about my company to mentor. And he just, all of a sudden, he wanted me to go sit down, pull out a paper, and he started mentoring me on economics of one unit. And he just, like, it was just amazing, just the sparkle that came to his eyes that he could help me or advise me on my entrepreneurial venture. And that mentoring and what he shared with me that day led to us bringing in our biggest contract we've ever had.
Well, certainly a mentor relationship can make all the difference. And it's just a matter of, like you were talking about, making sure that it's being communicated correctly. And but to your point, I think the first step is just getting started with it. So,
no, absolutely. I think it's important. People should really understand that our younger generations, when you ask them to teach you LinkedIn or how to Skype, how to, they're more productive and collaborative using technology. When you ask our younger generations in the workforce for help, understand that's not a sign of weakness. It's strength. And they're incredibly honored and empowered that they have something to share. And I think there's a real opportunity from that perspective. And then people who've been in the workplace longer are savvy, understand the politics of work, have connections and network, and know how to build these really long-term quality relationships. And that's a huge comparative advantage to share with our younger generations. So there's just a lot of opportunity here for win-win. And one thing that's been interesting is I've gone around the globe focusing on mentoring cultures and sponsorship. A sponsor is like your advocate, someone who champions you for a promotion or an opportunity. But less than 40% of people I talk to in any room, any conference, anywhere in the country, less than 40% will say they have someone they can go to for professional advice and mentoring. So what we found, and I would share this with companies listening, this needs to be engineered a lot more than we realize. Mm. To make it safe and comfortable, and it has to be supported from the top, that we're a company that believes, as you both have said, in a mentoring culture.
Julie, thanks so much for joining us. And, you know, this is not a one-and-done type of conversation. I think we need to kind of catch up with you throughout the year on your endeavors and some lessons learned along the way. So if you would be amenable to it, we'd love to have you back on the show in the coming weeks and months.
Oh, anytime. I'm a big fan of your show and love talking about this and learning from you and the amazing people that have come on your show and leaders. So much learning and such a great program. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks, Julie.
Well, George, that was a wonderful conversation with Julie Cantor from Two Mentor. But as Ron Popeil would say, wait, there's more, because we've got a great guest, Dominic Quartuccio, who is an author and international speaker, motivator, coach, great person, and a veteran of the financial services industry, is joining us. Dominic, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing really well, Jeff. Thanks.
Well, we're so thankful to have you on the show, and we just finished a great segment with Julie Cantor on the importance of mentoring, and it's really important that we come to you, because I think one of the things that you do really well in your job now is you're a coach and you're a person who helps lead people from point A to point Z, and I think you gained a lot of perspective from having been in our industry previously. So just wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, maybe the evolution of your career, and then also, you know, kind of how that translates into the retirement industry and kind of what you're doing today.
Okay, great. Yeah, I spent 15 years in retirement services, all with Prudential Financial, all in the retirement division, all within sales. So started out on the sales desk, and then, like pretty much everyone who's on the sales desk, the dream to get out in the field and own your own territory came to me at an early age with a great opportunity to cover the Northeastern region. I was living in New York City, still am. And then for the last 4 or 5 years of my career that went through February of 2016, I was running a sales team for the eastern half of the country, a number of sales support functions. And it was a beautiful career with a wonderful company, wonderful people, with an excellent mission, and in an industry that I still have a passion for. And a big majority of my work that I end up doing is back inside that industry. Like, as you said, Jeff, as a coach, as a group facilitator, as a mentor, and as a speaker, and what I have a particular passion for is seeing how many people and organizations are charged with these big, big new goals that seem to rise exponentially every single year on the backs of maybe fewer people. And you see these amazing high performers continue to rise to the occasion. And at the same time, in the private moments when they share with me, they say, Dominic, you know, I'm starting to feel the strain and the stress of meeting these rising demands. I have a particular passion in helping high performers to cut away some of that stress, increase some of their capacity to meet those rising demands, while also feeling like they have a new lease on the command and control that they have over the future they're creating for themselves at work and also at home with their families.
Nice.
I'm sorry, George, go ahead.
And I think that habits are such an important thing. And I have to imagine that some of these high performers that you're referring to, they probably already have pretty solid habits. Are there certain areas that you found across the board or pretty consistently that there's an area that people can make an improvement and see a pretty powerful return from?
George, that's a great question. One of the statistics that I love is neuroscience has shown that 95% of what we think, feel, and do falls below our conscious detection. So 95% of what we think, feel, and do falls below our conscious detection, and 5% of what we think, feel, and do is conscious. And most of us would think that it's the opposite, you know, that our conscious mind is the one sitting in the driver's seat navigating a vehicle, when in actuality, our conscious mind, for the most part, is sitting shotgun. And the 95% that's in our unconscious, that's where our habits and our patterns exist. And so high performers would not be at the place that they are without having a strong set of habits that have gotten them there. However, what I start to see is when people hit this ceiling of complexity, where you put in 50% more effort and you're only getting 5% more production in your sales or 5% more free time or whatever it is that's important to you, if like that ROI just seems to be not paying off, then it's usually that there's a habit or pattern that's in that uninspected 95% that's holding you back. And, you know, to your question, one of the things that I see high performers, especially in the time industry, doing really well, have built this acumen around working really, really hard. There's never going to be a replacement for hard work. But if you think about the analogy of if you have like an 8-cylinder engine, one cylinder is hard work. And people have gotten really, really successful on that, right? Like putting the nose to the grindstone, 12-hour days, 14-hour days, whatever it is. And when you learn to, when you double down on that one cylinder of an 8-cylinder engine, that's where you start to experience the diminishing return. And what I offer up is saying, listen, there may be 5, 6, 7 other cylinders that you haven't even explored yet. And they could be different for different people. But one of the biggest things that I see unexplored is people's relationship with productivity. And I think the definition of productivity is broken. People ask me all the time, George, they ask me the wrong question. Dominic, how do I get more done? And the reason why that's the wrong question is because people just end up adding more smaller dots, smaller things to their ecosystem. Like, how do they get more emails done? How do they attend more meetings? And what I'm saying is actually that the question should be something different. It's how do I do less and have a bigger impact? And a relentless focus on how can I curate doing fewer things, but really doubling down on the things that matter. There's never space for that when you're constantly doing more. So usually that's around curating proper time habits. Like, what's the first hour of your day look like? What's the last hour of your day like? Do you have a strategy for that? Because everything that happens in between is basically based on how you structure that first and last hour. Most people spring out of bed onto their cell phones, already in a reactive mode, and are so exhausted at the end of the night that they disappear into Netflix or the endless scroll on their cell phone at the end of the night, and they repeat it every day, and that's why you can feel overwhelmed and maybe not as productive as you'd like.
I think I fall, George, Dominic, I think I might fall into that latter category. I do stream Star Trek The Next Generation sometimes on my couch, and I kind of wallow away my sorrows in a little Jean-Luc Picard. I mean, I think this is fascinating. It's about how to change people's frame of mind and make them better. And you need help doing that. You can't do that. A lot of times you can't do that on your own, and you need someone to kind of pull that out of you. So how do we take what you do, which is obviously very important, it's led to great successes, and try to do something similar in our retirement communities, in getting people to, they know they need to save, but what do? They push it aside and they say, I'll do it next paycheck, or I'll do it next month, or I'll do it next year. There must be some, you know, and someone who's kind of crossed over, you were once a retirement professional. Now you have seen the light, you have saved, and now you've moved over to your industry coaching people to be high achievers. Are there any takeaways that can be applied back to make people save better than they are doing today?
Yeah, it's a great question. Everything boils down to human behavior. And so whether or not people are making poor decisions with respect to saving now, or eating healthy now, or creating more time for the important things in your life now, what that all requires is a change in behavior. And we are naturally resistant to changing behavior because the number one thing, the number one motivator, behaviorally speaking, is to avoid pain, right? And we've seen studies about this time and time again. Daniel Kahneman, one of the Nobel Prize winners, who talks about we are twice as likely to avoid risk than to go towards gain. And his work has influenced the financial services industry quite a bit. He wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow. And so when I see people avoiding pain, regardless of what it's important for, right, like around saving for retirement or their health, et cetera, it's usually because something is more pressing in this moment. And what I coach people to is to say, if you can start to connect whatever that behavior is that you're looking to employ, like better savings behaviors, how do you bring that into the present moment where you feel pleasure now through saving? And that's going to be different for a lot of people. And I think that record keepers and investment advisors have to get really specific around the different classes of people and what their response is. But how do you bring that feeling of pleasure into this moment so that people make that decision, but also maybe a little element of pain into this moment that can be relieved through saving? And I don't know if I've had a chance to see, or I don't know if I've witnessed anyone really cracking the code on that, because anything that's too far down the road, any payoff that's future-based, there's less of an attachment to that than there is something that's happening right here and now. I think there's an opportunity for more exploration of human behavior in the way that we communicate with, say, participants and other people to make those better decisions.
Dominic, that is a lot of good stuff there. I appreciate the time. Appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks, George.
Yeah, Dom, this was great. And, you know, I think we'd love to have you come back on to talk about this and other great topics during the year if you're amenable to that.
I'd love to, guys. Just let me know and we'll wrap again.
Well, great. Dominic Cartuccio. That was Dominic Cartuccio. He is an international speaker, international traveler, author, and former financial services executive. Dom, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Jeff, George, thanks, Dallas.
Thanks, bud. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye now.
Thanks.
All right, we are back. Special thanks to Dominic Cortuccio, speaker, coach, performance leader, for joining us and giving us some great insight. And joining us now is Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Jacob, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I think that Jeff and I are having fantastic Fridays. So,
and happy. And I should. We didn't even talk about Friday the 13th.
Oh man.
So maybe
yeah, Friday the 13th.
It is Friday the 13th, so maybe you'll bring us some good luck instead of bad luck, Jacob.
Yeah, hopefully.
So I remember reading about real estate in San Jose, and I think that it was the first city in the United States to have the average home value be above $1 million. And now there's something new that's happening there, Jacob.
Yeah, so there is a property in San Jose that is being sold for $800,000. The catch is that the house is completely burned out. There was a fire there 2 years ago, more or less completely destroyed the property. The realtor isn't even allowed to take people inside to look. So what's really being sold is the land value. And the realtor told me that she's already received one offer above the asking price. So that's in excess of $800,000. And, you know, situations like these are certainly not unusual somewhere like San Jose and are increasingly becoming more common in other markets across the country.
Yeah, it is a dynamic times with real estate. And
yes, for sure.
That's an interesting euphemism. And in regard to when you think about home equity and then you think about how large some of these home values are, there's some interesting information on that as well.
Yeah, so, you know, home values are increasing at such a pace that homeowners in certain markets across the country will actually earn more per hour from their rising property prices than a minimum wage worker in that same city would earn. So, for instance, if you take a look at San Jose, you know, home values there increased over $99 every hour between February 2017 and February 2018. And that is about more than seven times larger than the city's hourly minimum wage of $13.50. So, and that's not, you know, that's not exclusive to somewhere like San Jose that's like, you know, known for being a very expensive housing market. You see similar situations, you know, all across the country. You know, at a national level, the hourly increase in property prices over the past year was $7.09 per hour, and the federal minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. So you know, this is an issue that's occurring across the country, and it's good for homeowners, but makes it certainly more difficult for home buyers, folks who don't already own property.
That is a fascinating statistic right there, $7.09 an hour on average.
Yeah. Huh.
Who knew, man? Jeff, we should just pool all of our money and buy a bunch of houses and stop working.
Yeah, I guess. I've watched, like, Flip Your House, and I don't think I'd be really good at that kind of work.
Okay.
But yeah, it
seems
like...
It's definitely a challenging situation, just to jump in. Yeah, because, you know, in this report, you know, when I was reading about this report, I make a note of it in the story I did on it. You know, for homeowners, this is all good and well, and certainly will be great for them when it comes time to sell. But, you know, part of the reason why homeowners are able to see – part of the reason why these property prices are going up so much is because homeowners aren't selling. And one of the reasons they aren't selling is because there's nothing to buy out there.
Right.
And so if you can't sell your house, you can't take advantage of that equity you've built unless you get, you know, a home equity loan. And we are seeing more cash out refinances and things like that. But those are the types of loans that in some ways, you know, homeowners got in trouble with before the Great Great Recession. So, you know, if you're a homeowner and you're looking to tap into that equity, you definitely want to be careful and, you know, examine what you can afford in terms of interest rates and things like that, because you don't want to put yourself in the situation that many homeowners found themselves in, you know, the 06, 07 years.
Well, as soon as they start selling negative amortization loans again, that's when I'm just going to pull it all out and shove it in my mattress. So, of course, yeah. I don't know where my mattress will be, because I would have sold my home at that point. So I will put it under Jeff's couch, because I'll be living in Jeff's place.
That'd be great. We could do the – it'd be a lot easier to do the podcast.
That's true.
you know, Jacob, you know, next week is tax day. So we all owe our taxes to the federal government unless you extend your taxes. Any thoughts, any lessons learned, any things your organization are picking up on in terms of stories related to tax day?
Yeah, so one thing that one of my colleagues, Maria LaMagna, reported on this week was, you know, the increased popularity of tax refund advanced loans. So these are loans that people take out that allow them to tap into what they are expecting in terms of a tax refund in advance of receiving that, because, you know, it can take about 3 weeks on average to get that tax refund in your bank account. So, you know, last year we saw 1.7 million of these loans taken out, according to the National Consumer Law Center. And you know, companies like H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt, you know, the bigger tax prep companies, you know, they offer these to their customers, and you know, they use them to attract customers. But they're not foolproof. Sometimes consumers will turn to these instead of payday loans, which have high interest rates. But lenders charge tax prep companies for each loan they issue, and those fees that they are being charged, the tax prep companies are being charged, are almost certainly being passed along to consumers in the form of other fees. So, you know, it can make the whole tax prep experience more expensive. And a lot of folks for whom this is, you know, an attractive offer, because, you know, they are, you know, tight for cash, you know, those are the types of folks that should look into whether they can file their taxes for free. So for the folks who are out there who have not filed yet and were considering something like this, you know, it may not be advantageous in the long run. It might be better to hold off on getting your actual tax refund than getting one of these loans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really good advice, or at least insight. And obviously, this you know, leads me, George, to think about how we are a nation of consumers, and consumption is, you know, top of mind. So if you have to take a loan, you really have to think through the process of taking a loan, why you're taking a loan, what are you buying, and then the ramifications of taking a loan. One of the biggest areas beyond just normal loans is student loans. People have a lot of student loan debt. They've got to manage the student loan debt. They have high interest rates that need to be paid down. So, you know, I think it just goes back to prioritization. You know, just, I guess my words of wisdom or my insight, I guess.
I think that certainly does make sense. So hard to look at anything in a vacuum. If I were to look at tax refund advanced loans in a vacuum, I would say that they are not necessarily the greatest thing in the world, but it depends on everybody's individual situation. So,
Of course. And they can – oh, sorry, no, just please, to jump in, I do want to say they can be – less expensive in the longer run than payday loans. So for someone who is considering a payday loan, a tax refund advance loan might be a better option, but you know, still, all things considered, might be better to hold off.
So Jacob, I've got all these diamonds that I'm interested in buying or selling. Any insight on knowing if I'm getting a good deal or not?
Yeah, so this was a big story for us this past week. Drew Brees, who is the veteran quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, it was reported that he was suing a California jeweler who sold him and his wife about allegedly $15 million in investment-grade diamonds. But what the Breeze family soon found out was that the diamonds were actually worth about $6 million. And he, according to the jeweler in question, he said that he marked up the diamonds, but he charged that price because he believed that the diamonds could be resold in 10 to 15 years for a higher price. And so, you know, this, this kind of shows, you know, how, you know, diamonds are one of the most sought after, you know, gemstones out there, you know, worldwide. But they are not good as an investment, according to, you know, financial advisors. You know, you know, if you want to buy a commodity, you know, gold and silver bars, you know, those prices are easier to understand, in part because, you know, diamonds, they vary so much. You know, they vary in terms of their shape, in terms of their clarity, and that makes it harder to set standard prices. And, you know, you might be able to get that money back in a 20-year time frame or something like that, but in the shorter term you're not likely to. And, you know, most jewelers will do some sort of markup because, you know, that's where they make their money, is in terms of, you know, cutting the diamonds, setting the diamonds, things like that. So you know, once you take into account, you know, those markups, you know, any those markups will probably you know, negate any increase in value that the diamonds themselves have had over time.
There it is. Excellent stuff, Jacob. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Yeah, I mean, we're heading into the weekend. It's a beautiful day in New York City. It's been a great show. We've covered a lot of ground this week, haven't we, George?
We have covered a lot of ground. And it is nice out, but I might just stay in. I've got the newest episode of The Apprentice recorded, and I hear it's a good one, so...
Well, who's the host of that now?
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm going to be watching Star Trek: The Next Generation, as we discovered on the last segment before Jacob. I'm a huge Trekkie, although I don't go to conventions. But I don't look down my nose and say I wouldn't go to a convention. So I'm going to be relaxing this weekend and thinking about next week's show. I think we've got some great guests planned. Jacob, what are you up to this weekend other than chilling out?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to hopefully be finalizing my taxes. I'm in that same boat with thousands of Americans out there, so got to get ready for tax day. So hopefully we'll get the final touches on those. I as a personal finance writer, I try to not admit to waiting so long, but such is life.
Well, that's just I mean, that's just human behavior, right? We put off the exactly. Painful. I think we've been talking about that all show. Well, thanks very much for sitting in and participating. And I know Allie's coming back next week, but maybe you guys can form the dynamic duo of personal finance, and we can have you both back.
Yeah, would love to come back.
That'd be wonderful. So, George, my friend, always a pleasure. It's been a great hour of fun. Actually, a little bit more than an hour. But it's been a great hour of fun and learning from my perspective. And appreciate working with you. And have a great weekend.
You too, brother. We will talk soon.
All right. Bye, guys.